So I want us to take our time today to talk about some of the changes that are going on in the world around us, particularly in North America, and then address the ways that some of our thoughts and processes and theology might actually speak to that. Let me open us in prayer, and then we'll continue. Gracious God, thank you for the work that you're doing through this collection of schools and through this denomination and the expressions of this denomination through education. Thank you for the faithfulness of your servants here and their willingness to seek after your will and heart for your world. We pray this in your name. Amen. I'm just thankful because I've had some positive interactions with both the denomination and this network of schools. I was able to speak at Iowa a couple of years ago, I believe, and also at the seminary and places where this body connects. I'm also a huge fan of your former president, Joanne Lyons. I did a study on kind of, if I can put it this way, evangelicals that are not jerks and are nice people. And Joanne Lyons was kind of at the top of the list of those evangelicals who are not jerks. And so that reflects well on the denomination that would have on who your leader was. So I want to talk about, I'm going to use a process that was developed by Eldon Villafañe, who was my mentor at Gordon-Conwell. And he's drawing from the work of Holland and Henrio, who were Catholic theologians at in Chicago. But Eldon was had developed an approach to practical theology. And he lists three different categories to try to develop practical theology. The first is clarification, which is, what is the context of our ministry? What is the context of the world we're living in? To do a social analysis, to do a reflection on the world that we're living in, so that we're not kind of speaking into the air. We're actually trying to understand what is going on. So clarify the context of our ministry. The second category is conceptualization, and that's the key word there being concepts, mainly theological concept. What is the theology that speaks to our context? Now, when I teach this, what I'd usually say is that I'm not asking you to create a new theology out of the air. That's not what's happening. Most of you come from very rich theological traditions, Wesleyan traditions, holiness traditions. These are important theological roots that you are coming from. What we're trying to do is not create new categories of theology, but seek ways to apply that theology in a way that speaks to the context that we're in. So clarification, conceptualization, and the third category is confrontation. And that's just a pretty basic way of saying, how do we develop methods, practices, approaches that connect our theology to the context, connect these concepts to our context. So we're going to try to do about at least the first category we're going to cover well. Second category I'm going to introduce. Third category I'm going to say up front I'm not going to get to. But that's part of a job of what boards do. You try to understand what's going on in your context. You draw upon the rich resources of theology that you, as part of your denomination and your tradition. And then you think of, how do we connect it so that we are doing effective ministry, effective education, effective practice and methods? So that part is up to you. I'll give you the tools for clarification and conceptualization. What's going on in the world around us? What are some theological themes that are helpful? But the connection between theology and practice and context is the hard work that boards will have to do. So let's begin with clarification. What is going on in the world around us? I'm going to look at it from two angles. One, what is happening in terms of Christianity throughout the world, and what is happening that is unique in Christianity in North America, specifically the United States. I'll begin by quoting or referencing the work of Dana Robert. Dana is a professor at Boston University, a phenomenal scholar who's done some good work on the changing face of Christianity in the world. Dana is along with a group of scholars like Laman Sane, who passed away very recently, actually like yesterday, I believe he passed away. He was an African theologian, African missiologist, who taught at Yale Divinity School for many years. And along with Barrett and Johnson, Philip Jenkins, Andrew Walls, there's a whole community of missiologists and historians who've studied this phenomenon. But Dana Robert asks the question in this way. If you were to find the typical Christian in the year 1950, so we go back in time, we go to 1950, we get all the Christians in the world together in one massive room, and we say, let's pick out one person who represents Christianity in the world. And if you were to say that one person is a 50-year-old white male, living in an affluent Midwestern North American suburb, That would actually be a fairly good synopsis of the typical Christian in the year 1950. Maybe not Larry the Cable Guy in the corner, but the others would be reflective of a typical Christian in the world in 1950. A white male, approximately 50 years old, upper middle class, living in a North American suburb. If you were to take that same question and ask it in, I'm going to say, I have on here 2018, I haven't updated my slides since 8 days ago. In 2018, what is the typical Christian in the year 2018? Dino Roberts says it is a radically different answer. It is no longer the white male, approximately 50 years old, living in a Midwestern suburb. It is actually a Nigerian peasant woman outside of Lagos. It is a university student in Seoul, South Korea, or a teenager in Mexico City, Mexico. These are the faces of Christianity. So we've got all the Christians in the world together right now. The faces of Christianity would be very different than the faces of Christianity 60, 70 years ago. This has been captured very well by Philip Jenkins, who's one of the key authors who summarized a lot of these findings. He notes that over 500 years, and he's looking at kind of 1500 to 2000 or 1400 to 2000, the majority of Christians was tied up with the history of Western culture. That you can say that the majority of Christians in the world during those 500 years were in Europe and North America. And you can speak about kind of a Christian, European, Western civilization. But what he also notes is that if you look over the last 100 years, which he's looking at the 20th century, 1900 to the turn of the millennium, the center of gravity in Christianity has shifted away from Europe and North America to Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And then in the new century, the 21st century, the boom in Christianity will be focused not upon Europe and North America, but upon Africa, Asia, and Latin America. This, by the way, is fairly well studied, fairly well documented. Pretty much every scholar, historian, missiologist will affirm this statement. Andrew Walls, David Barrett, and Todd Johnson. Dana Robert. There's a whole crew of Lamansane, whole crew of scholars who've studied this phenomenon, both statistically as well as kind of looking at these trends. One of the factors to note is that Barrett and Johnson, who documented the numbers on this, noted that if you were to take a pin and put it on a map at the demographic center of global Christianity in the year 1900, you would have put it right in the middle of the North Atlantic Ocean, because that's where Christianity had clustered, Europe and North America, in the year 1900. But by the year 2000, if you were to take that pin and say, what is the population center of Christianity, it would have been right outside of Timbuktu, Africa. And they note that every week or so, you would take one step southward and one step eastward, because it's moving at that rapid of a rate away from the North Atlantic, further and further to the southern and eastern hemisphere. Now, most of you already know this. I'm going to put some numbers up that might help you to kind of grasp these drastic changes. But these changes, again, have been fairly well documented. In 1900, if you got all the Christians of the world together, only 2% of that group would have been African, and only 4% of that group would have been Asian, and 68% of that group would have been in Europe. So in the year 1900, you had an overwhelmingly European and North American-centric Christianity. The majority, the overwhelming majority, and if I were to kind of, again, I have these in quotation marks, but if I were to say of the white continents of Europe, North America, and Australia, what percentage of Christians live on those continents, we would say 80 to 85% of the Christians of the world in the year 1900 would have been on Europe, North America, and Australia, New Zealand. About 100 years later, that number changes very dramatically. It goes from 2% population of Africans as in the Christian world to almost 20%. 4% in Asia to 17%. The biggest drop, of course, is Europe. It goes from 68% of the world Christian population down to 26% of the world Christian population. You see a jump in Latin America. North America is relatively flatlined. So it means that the percentage is flatlined, but it means the absolute numbers are probably growing during that time. So if you were to say, well, the non-white continents then, what percentage do they make up? Africa, Asia, and Latin America make up 60% of the global Christian population. Yes. It's multiple factors. One factor is definitely the kind of the mission century of the 1900s. The other factor is Lamansane's thesis, that one of the things that happened is that the growth of Christianity was actually most noticeable post-World War II. And what happens post-World War II is that the European colonization of the world, places like, especially places like Africa and Asia and Latin America, it ends kind of the era of colonization. And so what Sane notes is that the growth and explosion of Christianity in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, particularly Africa, coincides with the departure of the missionaries. And what really happens is the adaptation of the Bible into an indigenous language. And in his book, Translating the Message, what Sane notes is that it was actually the major difference between Islam and Christianity, that Christianity was able to be translated into the indigenous language. And it was therefore not just linguistically translatable, it was culturally translatable. And so what Sane points to is that post-World War II is when you see this huge explosion of Christianity in the third world, non-Western world. A lot of that has to do with the indigenization of Christianity, linguistically and culturally within these places. So, but it's also population, right? So you get a population boom in Africa, Asia, and Latin America that coincides. So what I'm going to point to in this next slide is you're seeing actually countervailing trends. The sharp decline of Western Christianity and the sharp spike of non-Western Christianity. So when you get that together, these are the numbers that you get. So of course the projection then, because of the combination of these numbers, is that by 2050, the non-white continents, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, will be 70 to 71% of the world Christian population. Now, you see Africa, that number is spiking. Almost 30% of the Christian population is in Africa, 20% in Asia. Europe, if you compare the 150-year trend, just drops off the map from 68% down to 16%. Now, the other part of this, of course, is that this number is actually probably higher if you're not just basing it upon continents, but by populations within the communities. So, for example, European Christianity is no longer exclusively white. The fastest-growing church in London is a Nigerian church. The fastest-growing church in Stockholm, Sweden, is a Pan-African church. The fastest-growing, one of the biggest churches in Kiev is pastored by a Nigerian. The fastest-growing church in Paris is actually African church as well. So if you take that into account, I'm going to talk about North America as a trend line as well, this number probably goes up to about 80 to 85% of the Christians in the world if you count the non-whites in these European North American continent. This number is probably 80 to 85% rather than 70%. So if you take that 80 to 85% number, counting non-whites in Europe and North America, within 150 years, you completely flip that number around, right? So this number was the trend line for 1,500 years of church history. The majority of Christians in the world were Europe and North American descent, 80 to 85%. In 10% of the time, in 150 years, 1,500 years of church history was flipped over. This is the moment we are smack dab in the middle of. This drastic, dramatic change from a European, Eurocentric Christianity in 1900 that had been held for 1,500 years. In 10% of the time, we completely flipped this number on its head. This is the global cultural reality that we're dealing with. So, for example, when we one of my areas of study is in the area of church growth and megachurches. What are the two largest churches in the U.S.? Anybody know what those two churches are? In the U.S. Guess. What was that? Life Church. Yes, very good. Life Church is one of them. The second one is, who's the pastor there? Joel Osteen's church. Yeah, people don't know the name of the church. They don't say Lakewood. They just say Joel Osteen's church. Two of the largest churches in the U.S. right now. Both of them at roughly about 50,000. Lakewood and Houston, they former Rockets Arena, they packed that out, 50,000 people on a Sunday service. Life Church has a slightly different strategy. They have about 15 campuses around Oklahoma City. It's about 35,000, but if you count the online internet presence, it's probably another 15,000 more. So those two churches are about 50,000 each, Life Church and Lakewood, again, depending on how you count online attendance. Where are they in terms of relation to the largest churches in the world? Not even close to the top 10. Not even close. It's starting to, not even in the top 10. The church that has consistently held the top position for a long time, and it's starting to shift a little bit. What church has been the largest church for several decades now? Yeah, which church? Full Gospel Church in Korea, pastored by Young Gi Cho. He's retired now, but you know, it's still one of the largest churches. At its height, it had about 1 million people in its Sunday service attendance. Now, there's a church, I'm part of a fairly robust and growing denomination called the Evangelical Covenant Church. In fact, we're one of the few evangelical denominations that have actually not been declining, but actually been slightly growing. And we pat ourselves in the back for being a denomination that grows. And we are very proud of the fact that we're a denomination that has not been in decline. Our combined membership of all the churches is about 300,000, 350,000 members. So we're talking about a denomination that is actually growing in the United States, a third of the size of one church in Korea. So we got to put a lot of this stuff into context of how rapidly the church is booming in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. I believe three of the largest churches in the world are in Korea, the largest Pentecostal church, the largest Presbyterian church, and the largest Methodist church are all in Korea. Three of the largest churches in the world are in Latin America, and three of the largest churches in the world are in Africa. I believe the 10th largest church is now in Singapore. There's a couple of mega churches that are growing in Singapore. So what we're talking about is the American churches are not even close to the top 10 churches in the world in terms of growth. And this number, again, it's just one snapshot of it, but these numbers are indicative of how much Christianity has moved outside of North America and Europe to Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Now, again, this is old news. Documentation after documentation, statistics after statistics, study after study has proven that we are in a post-European North American Christian era. We are clearly in the era of diverse global Christianity. Most Christians, the overwhelming majority of Christians, anywhere from 60 to 80% within the next couple of decades, are going to be in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. My study has been, how has that affected Christianity in the United States and in North America? What are the trend lines? And are they reflective of the global Christian trend lines? Are American Christian trend lines also similar to what's happening on a global scale? And in order to understand American Christianity, we have to take two slices. The first slice is, of course, the changing demographics without regards to religious affiliation within American society itself. So American society as a whole is changing, and then we're going to have to see how that is impacting the church. And then the second, of course, are the trend lines within the churches and to see how that's affecting. And, of course, all of that and the implication for education, higher education. What does it mean for the future of higher education when the demographics of American society is changing and the demographics of the American church are changing? Let's begin with American society. In 1965, there was a pretty significant law, the Immigration and Nationality Act, or Immigration Reform Act of 1965. Philip Jenkins says that that act may be the most significant event of the 1960s. Now, you got to think about that for a minute, because a lot happened in the 1960s. Women's rights, civil rights movement, anti-Vietnam War, Cultural Revolution, all of these massive changes are occurring in American society. Jenkins says the Act of 1965 might be the most significant, and it might have the deepest long-term impact on American society and the culture of American society. So what happened in 1965? Here's what did not happen, and this is a common myth, fake news narrative. The idea is that in 1965, the American government changed its mind about immigration, and we just flung the doors open, let anybody and everybody in. And we've had this massive flood of immigrants since 1965. We had, you know, 10 immigrants in 64, but in 1966, we had 6 million immigrants. And now I'm exaggerating a little, but not by that much. There's this idea in 1965, we flung the doors open, let anybody and everybody in. That has never happened in American history. There's never been a moment where we flung the doors open and said, we're going to let anybody and everybody in. I'm sorry, there's one time that happened. That's when the pilgrims showed up and the natives said, yeah, let's let anybody and everybody in. That's the only time in American history where the doors were flung open wide for anybody and everybody. What happened in 1965 was part of the civil rights movement. It was an attempt to actually expunge from the laws, racist laws that were in the books as part of the civil rights movement. The first of these racist laws was actually called the Chinese Exclusion Act. Anybody know what that might have done? They weren't kidding around here. They said, I think we should exclude Chinese people. What should we call this act? I know, the Chinese Exclusion Act. So they were pretty explicit about what they were trying to do. They said, we don't like a certain group of people coming from a certain part of the world, so we're going to ban them from coming into the world. I'm so glad we don't do that anymore. So what we had was a law that was based upon racial preferences. It was a racist law. And it wasn't just that law, it was the first of the law, but there was a series of laws that said, we do not want immigrants from certain parts of the world. So what it created for more than a century was restrictions on immigrants that meant only immigrants were coming from Europe. Essentially, European immigrants were the ones that were allowed to come into the United States. What happened in 1965, again, was not the throwing open of the doors of this country, but actually a redistribution of the pie of immigration. So if in 1964 you had 200,000 immigrants, in 1965 you had 220,000 immigrants. And in 1966 you had 240,000 immigrants. Again, it was not 10 immigrants and then 6 million immigrants. What did change over the course of time is not the number of immigrants per se, that changes gradually as well, but the real change is in the distribution of immigration. And it opened the door in 1965 for more Asian, in particular, Asian and Latin American immigration. And that begins to change the face of immigration, again, not in 1 year, but over 50-plus years, you start beginning to see the gradual effect of this gradual change in immigration. So in 1965, you had the change in immigration laws, or more accurately, the reversal of racist laws that now changes the face of immigration. And over the several decades to present, you get the influx of non-white immigrants, which was prohibited prior to 1965. You now get that slow influx of non-white immigrants. So that by 2008, the U.S. minority population stood at about a third of the U.S. population. But here's the big, big change that occurred not that long ago. In 2011, the birth rate changes. This was a huge landmark moment. Most of us missed it. Half the births in America are now of non-European descent. By the way, that number is never going down. It's going to keep going up. Half the births in America are now of non-European descent, which actually makes the next statistic pretty self-evident and obvious. So if 5 years ago you had a birth rate that changed, 5 years later, what's going to change? The incoming kindergarten class is going to change. So 2016, 5 years after the birth rate changes, you have the rate of change within the number of non-white students who are now kindergarten students. But the rate starts to pick up because the birth rate, again, keeps just getting higher and higher. So that it is projected by 2023, half of all children, half of everyone under the age of 18 will be of non-European descent. And of course, the projection is that by 2040, somewhere in the decade of 2050, it's a projection, but somewhere in that decade, within most of our lifetimes, within the next 20, 30 years, half of all Americans will be of non-European descent. So what does this mean? It means that the browning of America is not tied to immigration, it's tied to birth rates. It's tied to birth rates. So we're going to have to deal with this reality. So I've been saying now for several years, the wall is not enough. We need to build a dome. That's my new mantra. Build a dome. We're going to seal this thing. We're going to get Canada to pay for a dome around this entire country. Nobody's getting in or out because we're going to build a dome. We build a dome. This will not change. And this will not change. The browning of America is a done deal. It doesn't matter how big of a wall you build. It doesn't matter how nice of a dome you build. It doesn't matter. The browning of America is a done deal. So part of the reality we have to deal with, no matter what our new immigration policy might be, none of that matters ultimately because this is a demographic sociological reality. And that's why when I say, when you're looking at the future of education and you're saying, we are not ready for this, if by 2023, you are not thinking about this number, you're probably not going to last very long as an educational institution. Let me be blunt about that. So here's an example. About 10, 15 years ago, I was asked to speak at a relatively robust-sized Christian college, about 2,000 students. It's kind of a long history of a denominational Christian college, long history. They were about 95, 97% white, and they had about 2,000 students. That was about 15 years ago. About 5 years ago, I was asked to come back and speak. And they were still 95, 97% white, but what was their student population? 700. It had dropped in like 10 years from 2000 to 700 because they were not taking this into account. This is just mathematics. Demographically speaking, if you are not reflecting this diversity, you're probably not going to last very long as an institution because this is the demographic reality. Any questions about this? It's a pretty important point to start with. Here's the other part of this, though. It's not just the changes in American society that we have to deal with, but it's the changing in the church that is huge, especially for Christian colleges and university. Initially, there was a thought that the more immigrants we get over the last 50, 60 years, the less Christian America will be. One of the key proponents of this thesis was a Harvard professor by the name of Diana Eck. She was actually a Hindu scholar that taught at Harvard for many, many years. She received $1 million from the National Endowment of the Humanities to study the changes in religious life because of immigration. I don't know what she did with $1 million, but it was not good research. Most of her findings are completely debunked now, mostly by the work of Stephen Warner, who I'll get to in a little bit. But Diana Eck said this: the more immigrants we get from outside of Europe and North America, the less Christian we will be, because Asians will bring their Buddhist and Hindu faith, and Africans will bring their other faith. And so the belief was that as we get more non-European immigration, the less Christian we will be. Now, to some extent, it is true that 35 years ago, in your neighborhood, you did not have a Buddhist temple. But now you do have a Buddhist temple in your neighborhood. But what Diana Eck missed and Stephen Warner realized was, yes, there's a Buddhist temple with about 50 to 75 folks who are attending that Buddhist temple. But during that same time period that the Buddhist temple was started, there were also 10 Korean churches that started, and 7 Chinese American churches that started, and 5 Vietnamese churches, and 3 Karen churches, and 2 Chin. All these churches started, 20 different Christian churches started, and you're obsessed about that one Buddhist temple that started in your neighborhood. So what Warner points out is that the new immigrants is not the de-Christianization of American society, but the de-Europeanization of American Christianity. That is a very important but subtle distinction. We are not becoming less Christian as a nation. The Christians in our nations are becoming, or noticeably, less white or non-white. This is not just what's happening in American society, but it is what is happening in the American church. The new immigrants make it decreasingly plausible for Americans to think of Christianity as a white person's religion. And although it may not be apparent in many congregations, American Christians are increasingly people of color. Again, what we're seeing, very similar to global Christianity, are countervailing trends: a sharp decline of white Christianity and a sharp increase of ethnic minority or immigrant church Christianity. So one of the ways we've tracked the decline of white Christianity is by this category. You all have to have heard this category before, right? Spiritual but not religious. I think the first time that it was used was in 1990, and it turned out that 4% of the American population identified themselves as spiritual but not religious. In the latest time that the survey was taken, how many were considered spiritual, identified themselves as spiritual but not religious? It went from 4% to 20%. It is unquestionably the fastest growing religious identification in America. Now, it's interesting to me because when I speak about religious identification, people are, and about immigration issues, people are particularly concerned about Islam and those who are Muslim. They say, we're worried about the growth of Islam. I believe from 1990 to 2005, the growth of Islam went from 0.4% of the U.S. population to 0.9% of the U.S. population. It's still in the single digits, like 1 or 2% of the U.S. population. So over the period of time, we had an incremental but very insignificant, numerically insignificant, increase in the number of Muslims in America. What is the greatest threat to America then in terms of Christianity? Not the number of Muslims. This group, 4% to 20%. And by the way, this group is mostly white Christians who have left the church. Mark Shevs did a phenomenal study a few years ago. And there are other works on this now. Kinnaman has done some work on this. I'm blanking on the second person who did some work on this. But Mark Shevs at Duke University did a study about the decline of the mainline church. He's actually a mainline person, and so he studies the mainline church. And what he noted is that in the decade, in the 20th century, you saw the decline of the mainline. It kind of goes like that. It just kind of falls through the floor. And the mainline churches, I think, lost like 25% of its membership in a 5 to 10 year cycle, which is massive. I mean, that's like huge. You can't survive when you're losing 25% of your membership in like a 5-10 year cycle. And what Shevs noted is that the decline in the mainline occurred in this way. There were two exit points for the mainline. One was actually out of the church altogether. They just left. They never came back to the church. They just went to, you know, stop going to church. And then the other group actually went into the evangelical churches. So that group were those who were part of White Flight. They were part of a Lutheran Methodist church in the city, and then when they were part of White Flight leaving to the suburbs, they didn't find a Lutheran church in the suburbs. They ended up joining the Willow Creeks and the Saddlebacks and the evangelical churches in the suburbs. So the decline of the mainline had two exit points, out of the church altogether and those who were going into evangelical churches. The evangelical church now over the last 10 years are showing the same trend lines that we saw in the mainline churches. The rate of decline is almost mirroring exactly what was happening in the mainline churches. That decline in the evangelical church has had only one exit, out. Very few are going to other churches. There's no other expression of Christianity that they're going to. There's a minuscule, relatively small number who are going back to the mainline. But the majority, the main exit out, is evangelicals leaving the church altogether, which is why this number keeps getting higher and higher. Because it's not, yeah, you still get the mainline exodus, but the real exodus is out of the evangelical church, and overwhelmingly, it's white Americans. So what we're seeing then is a pretty sharp and noticeable decline in American Christianity, but it's most noticeable among white evangelicals at this point. One way to track this was to first try to do surveys, and this was in the late 90s, early 2000s. Barna and Gallup did surveys to say what percentage of Americans attend church. And Gallup, by the way, has been pretty on during that time in guessing the presidential elections, because apparently people don't lie about who they're going to vote for. But apparently people lie about whether they went to church or not. Sociologists now call this the halo effect, as in they pretend that they have a halo. So what they do is when someone calls them, who are you going to vote for? They tell the truth. But when they ask, did you go to church on Sunday? They lie about it. Because Barna predicted, based upon these phone surveys, that almost 50% of Americans were attending church regularly. Gallup had that number as high as 60% of Americans are attending church regularly. Now, if you think about it, if you've ever been out on a Sunday morning driving around your town, do you really think half of the Americans are out there driving on their way to church? And even if it's half, do you really think they're going to church? Are they going to the football game, or are they going to the mall more likely? So this number seemed a little bit off. So Dave Olson from our denomination said, we can't trust phone surveys anymore, because for whatever reason, for particularly on religious identity, they tend to lie about these things. So he did something called headcounts, which is to take the attendance numbers from all the actual churches and just add up the headcounts. Now, even that number is probably slightly inflated. I know I was a pastor, and when I had to fill out my monthly report, I had 297 people that week. What did I write down? Of course I wrote down 300. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. I added them up too. So we end up with these numbers might also be slightly inflated, but they're probably going to be more accurate than self-reported projections, which is what Barna and Gallup did. So he was noting that if you did headcounts, you're probably looking at about 17.5% of the U.S. population attending the church. That actually feels a little more accurate to me when I'm thinking about when I'm out there Sunday morning, who's actually out there driving to church or on their way to church. That decline, then, is most noticeable among, again, in the last 20 years, among white evangelicals. This is PRRI's report in 2017, and the percentage of the population, and in just 11 years, it went from 23% of the U.S. population down to 15.3% of the U.S. population. This number is only going to go down further and further. It's a combination of things I'll get to in a minute. One is aging, which I'll get to, but also the nuns and the duns. They're leaving the church. And so this number continues to decline. What we are seeing on the other end of it, then, is the countervailing trend of not only the decline of white Christianity, but the sharp increase of non-white Christianity, as we mentioned before with Stephen Warner. If you were to take, for example, the growing denominations in our nation, the Baptist and the Pentecostal. Now, this is a little bit skewed in that when you say Baptist, you mean all the Baptists together. So Southern Baptist, National Baptist, and Southern Baptist is mostly white. National Baptist is an African-American denomination. But if you got all the Baptists together, it would be very confusing, but you would have a fairly diverse group of people. Same thing with Pentecostal. All the Pentecostals, you would have a fairly diverse group of people. The other end of this is that if you are not diverse, and especially if you're overwhelmingly white, you are probably a small or declining denomination. The Lutherans, 96% white, they're one of the fastest declining denominations. I don't actually know who the 4% non-whites are. I haven't met any non-white Lutherans, but apparently they're there. Congregational Episcopalian, 89 to 90% white, they're one of the fastest declining denominations. So the greater diversity tends to indicate the growth of the church. One of the ways that I learned this was about maybe 15 years ago, maybe longer than that. It was when George W. Bush was president. McCain and Kennedy had proposed the Comprehensive Immigration Bill. And they were trying to get faith leaders on board with this immigration bill. So I was at a meeting in Washington, D.C. with about 40 faith leaders. And one of the faith leaders was actually president of a fairly well-known, within the holiness tradition, Wesleyan holiness tradition, denominational leader. And he was very honest about the trend lines within his denomination. And he says, we are comparing ourselves to the mainline, which, as I said, at that time was in this precipitous decline. And he says, we pat ourselves as an evangelical denomination because we're not like the mainline. Mainline's losing 25%. We're actually relatively flatline. So we pride ourselves. We're not as bad as the mainline. He said, I will confess, though, if you took out the immigrant and the ethnic and the multi-ethnic churches from our numbers, meaning only the whites within our denominations, our numbers would look just as bad as the mainline. Those numbers, those evangelical numbers that are relatively flat, is being propped up by the immigrant churches and by the ethnic churches and the multi-ethnic churches that are in place. So that's the trend line. The other trend line is aging. So this is indicative of that trend line. Already by 2017, according to PRRI, in terms of identifying as evangelicals, now this is not a social political identification. This is identified based upon theology, based upon practices. So these would be people who are, you know, who have high view of the scripture. This would be those who, you know, attend church regularly. Those who identify as evangelicals using theological ecclesial categories, right now we are already at the cusp. We're 51% and 49%. My guess is that by 2020, the number of non-white evangelicals will easily surpass those of white evangelicals, again, based upon these trend lines. So what we're seeing is that among evangelicals, we're seeing a decline of Christianity among white evangelicals and a spike among Christianity among non-white evangelicals. Part of that also has to do with age. The average age of all Americans is 47. The average age of evangelicals is 53. Evangelicalism is a boomer phenomenon in terms of identification with some of the tenets of evangelicalism. White evangelicals' average age is 56. Black evangelicals' average age is 50. And here's the difference. Hispanic evangelicals, Asian Pacific evangelicals, average age is 40. This number should jump out at you when you are doing education. Because these folks are not going to school. This is the folks that are going to school. These are the folks that are going to be in your Christian colleges. They identify as evangelical, but they are in that much, and if you're talking about aggregate numbers, this is a huge difference between the average age of 40 and the average age of 56. That is like an astronomical gap between these two numbers. So if you're looking at the future of Christian education that appeals to a largely evangelical audience, this is your target, not this group. This is your target. Again, I go back to that story of the Christian college that had 2,000 members 15 years ago, students, and now they're down to 700, because they are still targeting here when this is actually the group that needs to be thought of as the group that's going to be coming to your schools. Let me pause there and see if there's any questions about the data and the information that I've presented. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll go right back to that. So
yeah.
How do we, as denominational schools, change our approach to recruitment and marketing?
Yeah.
To extend beyond our churches, which are basically white evangelical, to extend to those where the population is that we can serve.
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm not a marketer. I'm not a business person in that sense. But what I can say is maybe start trying. I don't know. That would be kind of the first step to say. You know, one of the things that I noticed about the previous school that I mentioned is that they weren't really trying. They hadn't even thought about the reality that I put up here. They hadn't even thought about it. And so even just to recognize this reality and say, okay, now what does that begin to look like? Now, I'll give you some negative examples. It was a Christian school that did a short-term burst to bring in, it was actually specific, Haitian students from New York in the denomination that had a huge historical outreach to Haiti, And so there were a lot of Haitian immigrants who were within this denomination. So they actually targeted one particular church that had a lot of Haitian college or college-age students. I think, and within a year, they had about 20 to 30 Haitian students, mostly from New York, but from all over, who were attending this school. About a year later, they canceled the French major. What's the problem there? 15 of the 20 students were French majors because Haiti is a French-speaking country. So what you ended up doing is actually what in systems thing called unintentional negative consequences. So you had those 20 students, that was a big deal. Hey, 20, 30 students, for Haitian students, we are now diverse, we're multi-ethnic, isn't it wonderful? They canceled a French program, 15 of those students drop out. Now, not only have you hurt those 15 students, what do? They're the first ones in their family to go to college. They're the oldest in their family. What do you think they're going to tell their younger brothers and sisters? What do you think they're going to do when they go back to their youth groups? And the, you know, hey, what was college like? Oh, don't ever go to the school. This school is awful. They just cancel programs on you, and especially the programs that Haitian students want to take. So not only have you damaged that effort short term with 15 students, you've probably damaged that effort for another 10, 15 years. So when you're starting to think about a strategy of marketing, it has to be a much more comprehensive strategy. It's, you know, you can't just change one thing here, one thing there, or change the marketing. So if you've ever read some work by Peter Senge, where he talks about, at the beginning of his work, Fifth Discipline, he talks about it's, you know, you have to change it because it uses beer as its main main illustration. But it talks about generating interest in a particular beer brand, but not having the right supply to meet that interest. And you create unintended negative consequences because now you've had to create a bad reputation for your brand because you don't have enough supply for the demand. So I see this in churches all the time. So here's an example I give for churches. A church wants to have and I teach this area of church growth, a church wants to have a church growth strategy. And they've heard that some of the best church growth strategy is advertising. So they spend money on websites and they spend money on, back in the day, billboards and, you know, telephone ads, all, you know, this is how old I am, telephone books, all that kind of stuff. So they do a media blitz. They go door to door, put stuff on doors, hangers, and all of that stuff. And so after that, this 50-person church have five newcomers come that week after the media blitz. Now, that's not bad, 10% increase in attendance. But what happens when the five newcomers come? A young couple comes for the first time. They have a child. And there's no daycare for them. There's no child care for them. So they're holding a crying baby, and they can't even participate in the worship service. So do they come back the following week? No, you weren't ready for them. Another person comes, a young person comes and sits in a particular row. But that's where, you know, Mrs. Johnson has sat for 50 years. And so Mrs. Johnson graciously decides to let this 18-year-old sit there. But she stares at the back of her head for 2 hours, and she can tell that somebody's staring at her for an hour and a half. And so is that person going to come back? So what have you done? You have created, yeah, you had a spike in attendance, but in the short term, you had the five-person gain, but are they ever coming back? And when their neighbor asks, hey, what was your experience at the church? Oh, don't ever go there. So marketing has to be coinciding with structural systemic changes that actually makes the marketing worthwhile. All right. Great question. Other questions? All right. Well, let me give a quick kind of positive reflection on... Hold on a second. Let me kind of shift to the theology piece a little bit in the last 15 minutes or so. The theology around confrontation, or the concepts of theology that speaks to this context, is that we cannot simply address this on a simplistic individual level. So this goes back to your question. If we market well to specific individuals, can we get individuals into our system? This is drawn from the work of Peter Berger and Thomas Luckman, who Berger was actually a Christian sociologist at Boston University. And the bulk of his work was responding to the God is Dead movement at Harvard. So Berger was a Christian who was seeing this God is Dead movement, and he was writing as a response to it. And one of the ways he responds to it is trying to find faith and religious life within systems and structures. And that's how Berger responds to the God is Dead movement at Harvard. So what Berger and Luckman propose is that there is a way that systems and structures are created. And they offer these three categories. And each of these categories offer a different angle on systems and structures. This is actually very much the individual idea. If you have good individuals who come into a system and externalize their goodness, you can change the system. But what we have to note is that it is only one of the three variables that is enacting change. The problem is, particularly around Western evangelicalism, we think this is the only way to change the system. If we just get that one good guy, one good person into a system, we can change the system. And that is actually kind of an intellectual fault within evangelical Christianity. The heroic individual that's going to change the world. The problem is the world really doesn't quite operate that way. We not only have broken individuals, we have broken systems. And saying that an individual can single-handedly change the system is probably faulty in its kind of intellectual basis. What you have to realize is that oftentimes, even after the externalization of the individual, you get an institutionalization, meaning that narratives, ideas, and values get embedded not only in the individual, but embedded within a system. That systems take on a persona and a life where you live out some of these values, not only by individuals, but by the system itself. And then that system begins to internalize it within individuals. And the individuals now are shaped by the system as much as they're shaped by their individual worldview. So this is where we have to have a better clarification in social analysis understanding. Are systems changed by individuals? Yes, they can be. But if you don't understand institutional social systems and structures, you will only have a limited impact on the system. And if you don't understand how much you have internalized the dysfunctional value of the system, then you will also have minimal change in the system. So with this internalization, it is likely that people are buying into the system they go into rather than changing the system. They will be corrupted by the system more than to be able to change the system. So what Berger and Luckman are proposing here is you have to take change on multiple levels, not just changing the individuals, which is a good thing, but you also have to change the systems. Now, you might contend with me on this. I'm going to take it to a third level, which is on this level. You not only have to change individuals in the system, you not only have to change the system, you also have to change the narratives that have been embedded in the system that also corrupt the system. I'll give you an example of this. The work of narratives is actually the work of Walter Wink, who writes about mediating narratives. Also, good work on this is Willie Jennings in Christian Imagination. And in the secular world, George Lakoff, communication professor at Berkeley, has done some really good work on how narratives and imagination change and impact the world maybe much more than even individuals and systems. So here's the way I would explain narratives. When you had a dysfunctional system, or identify slavery as a... Actually, let me take a step back. What are the narratives that drive our systems? So Wink identifies one narrative that drives kind of Western culture. And he calls it the mediating narrative or mythology of redemptive violence. It is believed that Western culture can act out in violence in a redemptive way, and that other cultures do not have the capacity for redemptive violence. And because of that mythology and narrative, a lot of the wars and a lot of the political conflict revolves around this assumption of a Western superiority that says the myth of redemptive violence, Western culture has the capacity to engage in redemption through violence. So I'll give you an example of this, and it's going to be controversial, but let's take a stab at this. So believe me when I say, my father was North Korean, and he's from Pyongyang, which is the current capital of North Korea. But by the way, if you don't know, Pyongyang, the current capital of North Korea, was the birthplace of Christianity in Korea. All the major churches started in Pyongyang. My father was actually a part of the exodus of Christians leaving North Korea, and they actually end up in Seoul and start many of the churches that kind of is contributing to the growth of the church in Korea. A lot of that was Pyongyang expats leaving North Korea to move to South Korea. Anyway, all of that aside, I do not believe that Kim Jong-un should have nuclear weapons. I think we can all, yes, amen. None of us believe that Kim Jong-un should have nuclear weapons. But I find it interesting in this debate around nuclear weapons, because we talk a lot about taking that weapon away from Kim Jong-un, but we don't really get a comprehensive picture of how we understand how weapons are used. So I'll give you this illustration. I walk into a room, and there are 12 people in that room with semi-automatic weapons, like, you know, AR-15 assault rifles. Now, I'm kind of nervous because I don't have one, but I'm seeing 12 people in the room with that. And one of the people I'm really nervous about is the guy in the corner who just got the weapon. He doesn't know how to use it. He's fiddling around with it. He doesn't, you know, it could go off in any minute because he has no idea what he's doing with that weapon. That's Kim Jong-un. So I'm afraid when I walk into the room with the guy who just got the weapon, he looks crazy anyway, and he's fiddling around with the weapon. But there's also one other person in the room that I'm maybe more afraid of. It's the one person in the room that has used that weapon to kill other people and maybe even civilian lives using that weapon. So we talk a lot about this guy shouldn't have that weapon, this guy shouldn't have that weapon, but because of the myth of redemptive violence, we don't stop to think, maybe we shouldn't have that weapon. Because we're the only nation that actually killed civilians with two nuclear weapons. So if you're actually not an American and you see this whole scenario develop in front of you, yeah, you're afraid of Kim Jong-un, but you might be more afraid of the United States, which has actually, as a nation, used nuclear weapons against civilians. So the new kid with a gun, you're afraid of him. But the kid who knows how to use the person who knows how to use the weapon and has killed civilians with that weapon, that person is also pretty scary. But the myth of redemptive violence says certain people can use that weapon and other people cannot. You understand how that mythology works, how that kind of starts acting itself out within our culture and society. But let's talk about this mythology. If these narratives are powerful, and as Wink argues, they fuel our society, they drive our society. In fact, what I would argue is that these narratives are so powerful, they are the fuel for dysfunctional systems. They end up getting internalized by the society, and it forms these systems. So one of the things that is one of the most destructive and harmful systems and structures that we've ever had in American society is, of course, the system of slavery. Complete dehumanization, complete sense of destruction of human lives, and just one of the worst sins in American history, no question about it. Now, what happened, though, is that that system of slavery was torn down. We had a civil war, we had the 13th Amendment, we had the Emancipation Proclamation. These things tore down the system of slavery. Praise the Lord, that dysfunctional, evil system of slavery is no more. But what drove and fueled that system of slavery in the first place? Did we allow that to live on? So that fuel, this narrative, if that continues on, then it's going to find another system to fuel. And that's exactly what happened. You had a dysfunctional system of slavery. It was torn down, but because the fuel was still there, the narrative was still there, it was replaced by Jim Crow. And to some extent, Jim Crow was just as effective as slavery in creating a two-tier system of society. To some extent, it's just as effective as dehumanizing black lives as slavery was. And so we needed another movement, a civil rights movement, to tear down this evil, dysfunctional system of Jim Crow. And we did. The civil rights movement, the Voting Rights Act, tore down the system of Jim Crow. However, did we deal with the narrative fuel that fueled slavery and that fueled Jim Crow? And what it led to was a new Jim Crow that might be just as effective as Jim Crow, that provides the system by which these narratives can continue to go on its merry way. That system is a devaluing of black bodies and a valuing of white bodies. It is a devaluing of those people of color and an elevation of those who are white. So if that narrative of superiority and exceptionalism is not dealt with, you can tear down system after system, but new systems will keep taking its place because the fuel will find an expression in new dysfunctional systems to express itself. Now, this is, again, kind of a conceptual idea. But let's start moving it into education. If, for example, we had dysfunctional systems that made education accessible for some and not to others, and that system needed to be torn down, segregated schools, the educational, economic restrictions on education. Those were pretty dysfunctional systems that prevented access to higher education for a significant percentage of our population. Those were horrible systems. We had to tear that down. But was there a narrative that created that first system in the first place that we didn't tear down? And that narrative of an assumption of the superiority of Western white culture over and against other culture. I'll give you an example. My first book in seminary was a book called All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes. I almost left seminary after reading this book. It was that bad for me. The book created these categories of culture. The first category of culture was called high culture. And the author identified high culture in this way. Shakespeare, Rembrandt, ballet, Bach, Downton Abbey. No, that last one I made up. But you get the idea. Western European high culture. That was considered high culture. And even in the language, it was higher than other culture. Now, he created another category, again, of Western culture, of low culture. And that would be Britney Spears and television sitcoms and Andy Warhol's painting of soup cans. That was considered low culture slash pop culture. Now, what the author ended up thinking about, though, was, okay, we have a high culture and a low culture. What did he leave out? Well, 99% of the cultures in the world is what he left out. So he had to create a third category called folk culture and pretty much dumped everything else into the category of folk culture. And folk culture was including African-American spirituals, Native American regalia, Korean fan dancing or Korean drumming. All those things that were reflective of non-Western culture, no matter how deep of a tradition it was considered folk culture. And the language this author used was that high culture could sustain and retain virtue over longer periods and generations than folk culture. In other words, high culture was superior to folk culture. So that, by the way, again, this was a book that I was assigned in my first day in seminary as the way I should understand culture. Now, you might say, hey, that's silly. Or you might say, hey, what's wrong with that? But understand if that's a narrative that is within your system and structure, and that gets communicated, how are non-white Western students receiving that message if that narrative is embedded in your system? How do they feel devalued within the system? How are they seen as unwelcomed within that system when the narrative within your culture of your educational institution, denomination, schools, is reflective? There is a culture that is superior to your own. And our educational process is to teach you that high culture and get you out of that folk culture. Let me pause there and see if there are any questions about the dominance and the power of narratives in formation of systems and structures. I'm glad to hear. Thank you. Now, what I'm going to say is, you know, some of this stuff is controversial, obviously. I want you to think about these as concepts. You know, I use illustrations that are, you know, controversial. The nuclear weapon thing is a fairly controversial illustration. But what I'm challenging you to think of is how a person could walk, especially a student, can walk into a context and feel unwelcomed, even though that's not your intention. Even though you're saying, we'll want you to be here, we welcome you here, are there narratives that are at play that actually undermine your external welcoming of this individual? And then again, going back to our clarification, how does that ultimately in the long run severely damage the lifelong, the ongoing sustainability of your institution? If in 2050 you are still an institution that presents this narrative, your student body will reflect that, and what will end up is you will be a very small school. You will be a dying institution, maybe even a dying denomination. What are the narratives that now begins to be changed so that 10 years from now, when the overwhelming majority of incoming freshmen are students of color, how are your systems and structures and the narratives within those systems and structures ready to affirm and serve and teach and educate and provide those resources for those students that are going to be coming into your classroom 10 years from now? Other questions or reflections? Yeah.
Ah. Family and Michelle Sanchez.
Yes.
Is one of my friends.
Good, good.
She actually just did some coaching with us at headquarters a little bit.
Fantastic.
I would love to hear maybe a couple of your examples.
Sure.
That you have used in the ECC.
Sure.
Whether it's higher ed or just in the churches.
Yeah.
Your confrontation, the connecting to yeah. theology to context. Because you
Excellent.
Have a track record.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
Sure. So there's a couple of factors in the ECC, and I'll talk about North Park as well. North Park, I think about 5 years ago, we crossed the threshold where the majority of our students are now students of color. There were a number of factors for North Park where that transition was possible. And I, you know, to be blunt about it, our location helped a lot. You know, we're in the city. We're in Chicago. We're, you know, two blocks from the Brown Line, which gets you everywhere in the city at some point. So that factor, and we're in a zip code in Chicago, 60625 zip code, that is the second most diverse in the whole city of Chicago. And I'm one of the top 10 in the U.S. So our location helped a lot, that we were able to, in some sense, capitalize on the serendipity of being in a Chicago location. Now, but there was some intentionality. So, you know, I don't know if this is going to apply to everybody, but while we require Christian identity and Christian doctrine and statement signed by faculty and staff, it's actually not required by the student body. Now, again, very similar to places like Pepperdine and Baylor and other schools that have a very deep Christian identity but don't expect that from students, that's kind of reflective of us as well. But part of that is a reality that the neighborhood we're in, my kids went to elementary school in our neighborhood. The neighborhood school is 50 different languages spoken at a school of 1,500 students and 71 different nationalities at a school of 1,500 students. So we're talking about extreme diversity. So the school, North Park, benefits from that, but also needed to make sure that we are tying in with that. So part of our non-Christian identity means we actually have a significant number of Muslim students because our neighborhood has a lot of Muslim families. And so there's kind of that factor, kind of tapping into the strengths that we already had exhibited. The other thing I think the Covenant did well, ECC did well, is to try to innovate in terms of looking at what is kind of coming on ahead. So, and I've looked at this as both a seminary professor within the denomination, but also in my own interest. One of the things that the Covenant did really well is it identified kind of young leaders of color and invested in young leaders of color to serve the communities, the diverse communities that were emerging. So about 10, 15 years ago, after it made a pretty strong public commitment to diversity, I believe it was like 25, 30 years ago, it made a strong public commitment to diversity. And about 15, 20 years ago, they started really recruiting heavily, someone like me. You know, I was 30 at the time, 35 at the time. I don't know, how old am I? But this was about 20 years ago when I had just started a multi-ethnic church. They found other young pastors of color and really said, this is the vision of our denomination. Would you join us with that? So folks like Ephraim Smith, Eugene Cho, Gideon Tseng, Danny Martinez, these are, you know, they're all about my age, 40s and 50s. And about 20 years ago, the Covenant really made an effort to recruit us. And so it intentionally sought out diversity. And I think it did a very smart thing, which was to look for kind of those with a theological, sociological vision similarity. So all of us were multi-ethnic church planters or pastors who were concerned about justice issues, but also very committed to kind of the basic evangelical tenets of Scripture and Christology. And there were enough of us to create kind of a momentum with that. So it was an effort to really identify leadership at a kind of a, you know, early 30s-something age and really intentionally shepherding that group towards leadership within the denomination. And it's actually showing. Danny Martinez now was our first Latino superintendant. Greg Yee was our first Asian-American superintendant, and both were Covenant church planters 20 years ago. And now they are, and they're about my age, so they... Can I say I'm young? I'm 51. So they're, you know, in their 50s, who are now superintendents. But it took 20 years, but they were identified as leaders at 30 and then developed along the way. So I would say, and Michelle Sanchez would be another example of that, the intentional effort to raise up leaders. I gave this example in the previous session. We were a small church that I pastored, you know, 200-300. We were never really larger than 400 was our height. But I met a young African-American senior, college senior, and he was at Wheaton College. And I went to speak at Wheaton, met him, and he was all set to go to Fuller. And I said, well, why don't you come to Gordon-Conwell instead? And he said, why would I go to Gordon-Conwell? Well, what if I hired you as an intern and paid for your seminary education at Gordon-Conwell? Would you come then? said, yeah, sure. I'm getting married, and she wants to go to Gordon Conwell too. Can you pray for her? Okay, fine. We'll pay for both of you to go to Gordon Conwell. But we were expecting, and his wife was Puerto Rican, he was African American, we'll pay for you to go to Gordon Conwell for 3 years, and you can, you know, intern at my church during that time. And they did. They were fantastic in serving our community. But what happened to Vince was, after 3 years, he graduated Gordon Conwell without any student loans. And he said, you know what, now I can actually do another master's degree because I don't have student loans. And he actually went to Princeton, got his THM, and then he ended up going to Catholic and got his PhD. And as far as I know, he's the only African American studying early African church history in that relatively small guild. He's actually the only one. Now, you know, our church played a very small role in that and was a decent-sized investment for a church of our size. But by paying for he and Deanna's education, we were able to raise up and she actually has a doctorate in ministry now, two doctoral students within, you know, Puerto Rican community and African American community who now have the capacity to serve, you know, academic world at large. And this was one small church, 300 people, with a small budget, which just said, we're going to invest in one couple to do that. Now, imagine if a denomination made that kind of call and said, we're going to think 20 years from now, not, you know, because I'll be blunt with you. If you are an African-American with a PhD and one of your institutions went to him and said, hey, want to come teach for us? They'll say no. Why? Because they just got an offer from Duke. They just got an offer from Indiana. They got an offer from University of Maryland. They got an offer from Yale. So why would they go to middle of nowhere, you know, when they could go to Duke? And that's actually happened with two of my professors at Duke, Jay Carter. Has his master's degree from Dallas Theological Seminary. His wife's father was the first African-American professor at Dallas Seminary. But he taught at Duke. Why would he go back to Dallas to teach? Willie Jennings, another one of my professors. His undergrad is from Calvin College, and his seminary degree is from Fuller Seminary. He was at Duke for many years, and now he's at Yale. Why would he go back to Fuller? Why would he go back to Calvin? So to be honest with you, most African-Americans or people of color with the credentials that you're looking for, they've got a lot more options, you know, than Indiana or Houghton or anywhere than these schools. But if you were to raise up from within your community and create maybe fellowship programs for faculty of color, now they might be only there for 3 years, but what a three-year ride that could might be, right? We had Vince and Deanna for only 3 years, but what a three-year ride we had. And then a long-term impact of that. So we're talking about a whole system of change, not just, you know, we're going to try to make our school more attractive to ethnic minorities. No, you were completely changing how you look at higher education and raising up within your communities faculty of color so that 20 years from now, there's no excuse because you've actually raised up your own. Yeah. Other questions or comments? I've got 3 minutes before I literally have to bolt out the door and catch an Uber. Yeah.
Could you say that the location of most evangelical higher education institutions is a huge detriment to
what you're saying? Absolutely. So some of my study has been on white flight and the negative impact of white flight. And part of white flight was not just churches, it was actually educational institutions as well. If you look at the more diverse Christian colleges, North Park would be one, we're in Chicago. NIAC, at one point, I think it still might be, is the most diverse school, period. Forget about Christian schools. They're 90% students of color. Where are they? New York City. So that's kind of built in right there. Azusa Pacific is now one of the most diverse schools. Where are they? Los Angeles area. They're not in LA itself, but they're in a very diverse, obviously, region of the country. So that is, you know, for good or bad, that is one of the clear factors in terms of location. Yeah. Yeah, and that's the history. Yeah, that's part of the history. And I will say that I've spoken to faculty of color who were at kind of places like this, and whenever I visit and speak at Christian colleges, the faculty of color kind of gravitate, and we have a session on talking about that. And universally, it's very difficult for a faculty of color to be in a neighborhood that is not diverse, right? To be in, you know, communities that are not diverse. And that's just yet another level of challenge for many of these faculty. Yeah, that's unfortunate reality. But there are other ways to kind of get around that. You know, one, If you bring in one person of color, you're probably going to, that person will probably leave in 2 years. Can you bring in a cohort? Can you bring in a, you know, community of scholars? Or, you know, just be more intentional about providing community rather than the one person coming in. Again, like I said, the unintended negative consequence. 3 years later, they had a bad experience, they leave, you know, and no faculty of color want to come there again. Let me just say this in a maybe to kind of send you forward with kind of a positive spin on this. You all are having the conversations you need to have, right? I mean, you chose to be in this workshop. You chose to actually talk about some of these questions. That is a lot of steps ahead of many of the Christian colleges that I've been to. You are a couple of steps ahead here. My challenge is, you know, if I said offensive things or if I said controversial things, please ignore that. Get to the truth of what's actually happening and think through what is God doing in this moment and how can I be a part of what God is doing. And so you're asking the right questions, raising the right issues. But let's, you know, keep pushing that and say, what is God doing right now? It's pretty exciting stuff, to be honest with you. Christianity is not dying in North America. It's flourishing. It's just not flourishing in the ways that we thought it was going to be flourishing 20 years ago. So but God must be doing something in that. So you're asking the right questions, and I would encourage you to continue to do that. Thank you for your time today. Really appreciate it. Thank you.